This What's Working with Cam Marston podcast is brought to you courtesy of Michelob Ultra Beer.
They say consistency is the key to success. They weren't wrong. So how about grabbing a beer that's consistently smooth, consistently refreshing, and consistently light? You might just find that the road to success can be pretty enjoyable. Michelob Ultra, the perfect balance of taste and refreshment, and only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. Enjoy responsibly. Anheuser-Busch Michelob Ultra Light Beer, St. Louis, Missouri.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is the radio show designed to bring you insights and trends influencing the workforce, the workplace, and the marketplace around us. I look for the guests that can give us feedback and give us insights in what's going on out there and help us with the trends that are shaping our own business with the hopes that something that we hear will allow us to do something in our own businesses just a little bit better. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business out of the University of Alabama. Again, everyone, welcome. Glad you're on for the ride. My traditional work, the work that's kept me busy prior to beginning this radio show, was in the seminar and the lecture business. And a lot of my clients for years have been financial services companies. In fact, as I sit here doing this, I've just finished preparing for a half-day program out in Denver with a financial services company. One of the issues that's been at the forefront of these conversations with these clients of mine has been financial literacy, how much there is to know in the world of managing your own finances. And I'm just talking about your personal finances. This is not business finance or anything like that. But there's a lot left out there that many, many people don't know. And a couple of pieces of data, or information rather, always catch my eye. Number one, everybody thinks that they're financially savvy. Everybody thinks that they're financially literate. Everybody thinks they know what's going on in the world of their own finances and how to work with a bank and things of this nature. But when you test them, they fail. So everybody thinks they have a lot of information, but none of them pass the tests. Number two, men are much worse at financial literacy than women. And it's usually the men who speak with confidence about their financial literacy. And I think we're seeing, and not number three, but I think we're seeing in a kind of tangential, a movement away from the male as head of household managing finances into the hands of the female. She is generally, speaking as a whole population, better educated. She's beginning to earn more money than the male. And I think the men are responding by giving her the reins of the finances of the household. What we've got prepared for you today is a show on financial literacy. There's a company out there called Sensei, spelled C-E-N-T-S-A-I, and I was introduced to them by previous guests on the show, and I'm going to have Arindam Nag on the show momentarily. He is out of New York City, hails from London, and he's made it his passion to teach financial literacy in an interesting way using his website of little tidbits of information, of stories, of things like that. Not a sit-down lecture, but a really interesting way of delivering financial literacy to the many people out there who claim to have it, but evidence suggests that they don't. When we come back, Arindam Nag and I will be on the line. Prior to break, though, let me talk to you or remind you about the professionals, my friends at Sandifer Wealth Management. Not all advisors are held to the same standards. A fiduciary duty is the highest standard of care under the law. Only registered investment advisors always have a fiduciary duty to act in your best interest. Jamie Sandifer, Mark Salyers of Sandifer Wealth Management act as a fiduciary to all clients at all times. Sandifer Wealth Management here in Mobile on Old Shell Road. They can work with you wherever you are. Give them a call. When we come back, we'll talk financial literacy. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business, all housed at the University of Alabama.
Think about how people really see you. The kid at the drive-thru just sees a coffee drinker.
Please pull forward.
Your local barista sees the person who loves a smiley face in their latte.
See you next time.
It's kind of the same way with insurance. Other insurance companies just see a customer, but a State Farm agent sees more. They see you as a neighbor. Your State Farm agent is here to get to know who you really are so they can help life go right.
Call me, State Farm agent Allison Horner, Mobile at 666-1616.
Back. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. On the line with me is Arindam Nag. He's out of New York City, the financial mecca that is New York City, by way of, I think you told me when we prepared for this, Arindam, London. Is that correct?
I did spend a lot of time in London. I actually grew up in England, and in India, but I spent a lot of time in London, yes.
Thank you so much for your willingness to join us on the program today. Welcome to What's Working.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Tell me a little bit about your background, if you could. Where are you other than London and India with your training, and what got you into this financial literacy passion of yours?
Sure. So I've spent most of my life as a financial journalist, and I've worked at a company called Reuters, which is now Thomson Reuters, which is one of the world's largest financial news agency. And then I spent many years working for the Dow Jones Group, writing for the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones Newswise, and a publication called Barron's. And it was during my last role at the Dow Jones Group, I was writing a column called The Herd on the Street. And the column, basically, its goal was to explain to the universe what's really going on, why are certain things happening. And during the 2007-2008 credit crisis, I had a ringside view, by virtue of my role, of what was really going on. And I realized fairly quickly that while it was very fashionable to blame Wall Street banks for some of the issues that we were seeing during the credit crisis, but the real problem goes back to lack of financial literacy among many, many Americans. So living with a lot of debt, taking on mortgages and credit card debt, which culminated into lack of, I would say, taking appropriate decisions that leads to a healthy financially healthy lifestyle.
So these big companies were selling things to consumers that the consumers should have known, this is not the right thing for me, or this is not a good idea. One position someone could take, and you referenced it a moment, is blaming the big financial services companies. But your position is, one of the larger part of the blame should go to the consumer who's taken on his or her third mortgage or something like that. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, third is an understatement. I've actually met people who have bought five homes and six homes. Why? Because they've been promised that home prices will continuously increase.
Yes.
So even if you're taking, let's say, a mortgage on your homes, it doesn't really matter because you can always refinance the mortgage into a lower interest rate or existing interest rate. But the reality is, at some point of time, banks stopped lending or refinancing those mortgages. So the mortgages went up after 2 years, which means your monthly payments went up. And if you're not getting enough income from your property, or if you don't have a tenant, then you're basically paying from your own pocket,
yeah,
which many people couldn't afford.
Right.
Hence the credit crisis.
So you faced essentially the financial services industry for a while. You were collecting information on them, but then you've pivoted. You've turned 180 degrees and said, I'm now going to face the consumer, because the financial services industry is going to chew the consumer up unless the consumer learns how to protect him or herself. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, yes, and that's a very good observation, because I also realized over time, and it is still a work in progress, that while Wall Street banks and some of these institutions, they work really hard well for the rich people, which is probably like 10% of our population. But for the remaining 85-90% of people, there is really not enough quality source of financial information that can guide you from day to day. And that's the problem that we're facing, and that is what Sensei, which is my company, Sensei.com, is looking to solve.
So tell us about Sensei. We know why you created it, but tell me what it is.
So Sensei is actually a financial education platform, and we are in three markets: educational institutions, workplace, and also in the financial services sector. What we have is we have one of the world's largest financial education focused content libraries in the world. And we also have it in English and Spanish. And we look at various financial pain points that people face day to day. And we offer them guidance. And the guidance is based on anecdotal evidence, personal stories. We also have gamification. So we make finance fun. The whole idea is that, look, we want to entertain you with our content, but in the end, you will learn something that will improve your financial life.
I'm on the line with Arindon Nag. He's with Sensei out of New York City. It's a financial literacy website trying to help the consumer learn a little bit more about what it is that they think they know. And Arindon, I want to build on that. My experience with financial literacy is if you and I were to go gather 10 people on the street, whether it's New York City or any one of my markets here in Alabama, and say, are you financially literate? Are you savvy around the way money and things of that nature work? Most would say yes, and therefore would not feel they have the need for the education on your website. Address that for me.
Yeah, and it's an interesting observation you make. Most people believe that if you are saving a bit of money every week or every month, that's good enough for you, number one. Number two, many people also believe that, look, as long as I'm physically fit and I'm continuing to earn my monthly salary, I am good enough. I will figure it out later on. And it is this figure it out later on approach to life that often comes back to haunt them for two reasons. One is, as you are growing older, your ability to income does increase. But after a certain point, especially when you're in your late 50s and early 60s, you're fast approaching that time period when you have to retire, because many corporations, many employers, unless you're running your own business, they have a cutoff point after which you will have to retire. Now, many, many years ago, people's lifespan was still around early 70s or mid 70s. Today, people live till 90s, late 90s, or even above 100 in many cases. You still have to support yourself. So today, it is incredibly important for someone to plan out your financial life properly with a game plan.
Yeah. One of the sponsors of this show is Sandifer Wealth Management, and they shared with me that it may not be uncommon in the near future that people could be retired longer than they worked. They may work 30, 40 years. And the way lifespans are increasing, it just baffles me that people could be retired longer than they worked. And the financial situation that they've prepared for themselves is not adequate. They're vulnerable.
No, you're absolutely right. And mind you, a lot of people have this notion mistakenly that as you grow older, your expenses will go down.
Now,
certain expenses do go down. You're no longer paying for your kids' education. You're no longer paying for your kids. But guess what you're paying for? You're still paying for increased healthcare. So if you don't have a proper healthcare plan, you're still probably have to pay more money. The home that you lived in, remember, if you're living in the same house for the last 35, 40 years, there is a high possibility that you'll have to take care of numerous maintenance expenses of your home.
Yeah.
You may need to pay for, you know, your spouse's nursing home expenses. So there are a lot of expenses that come in. And today, given the information available, they are no longer unexpected.
Yeah.
If you keep up with your homework and if you have a game plan, you can easily track what is coming.
Arindon, before we go to break, I want to hear a little bit more about Sensei, the website. Folks, by the way, it's spelled C-E-N-T-S-A-I, a play on words for the Japanese master, C-E-N-T-S-A-I.com. If you want to take a look, you're giving away an extraordinary amount of content on Sensei.com. And perhaps this is too, I cross a line here, but how do you fund this website, this research, this content that you're creating? What is the financial source for making this website?
Yes, it's a good question. So in full disclosure, the company has been bootstrapped, meaning me and my co-founder, Doria Lavanino, we actually brought the company to as far as we could with our own resources. But the company is a profit-making company. In other words, it's not a non-profit organization. We license our courses, our content to banks, financial institutions. We are also in the middle of a fundraise as well, which will actually support our growth. We now have products in three markets, and we have paid clients in all three markets: education, financial services, and as well as the workplace. Over the next couple of years, we will be scaling up our sales and marketing, and we do want to become one of the world's largest financial education companies in the world.
Yeah, that's right. You're partnering with the organizations that can expose your content to those that need it the most. It sounds good. When we come back from break, Arundhama, I want to hear from you the most common financial literacy, or maybe it's the financial mistakes. I'm not really sure how to manage the language of what we're talking about, but the most common mistakes that people make, and my listener is a 45-year-old or older, largely, I think 66% of our audience is male, and what they need to know, you know, what does somebody in this chapter of life, 45 years old and older, need to know financially? We'll address that when we come back from break. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston, on the line with Arundhama Nag out of New York City, by way of India and London, a truly international guest on the show today. His company, Sensei, C-E-N-T-S-A-I.com, financial literacy. We'll be right back. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama.
This is Trey Langus with Transworld Business Advisors. I help business owners sell their businesses from mom-and-pop size to large mergers and acquisitions. We have a huge buyer database looking for quality businesses to buy right now. Confidentiality guaranteed. If you're a business owner considering an exit within the next few years, let's talk. Again, I'm Trey Langus. Find me at Transworld Business Advisors or Google my name.
Customer service never goes out of style. In fact, I think it's safe to say that customer service is more valuable and more important now more than ever. Hi, this is Cam Marston. One thing that my over 200 episodes of What's Working has taught me is how important customer service is to building and maintaining a thriving business. It's the growing need for customer service that's led me to partner with one of the state's leading customer service trainers to create our program called Delivering 5-Star Customer Service. Your team will get one 90-minute training session per month for 6 consecutive months. Each session builds on the skills learned the previous month, allowing your customer-facing teams to practice before moving on to the next lesson. And the 6 lessons address everything from appearance to electronic communications to conflict resolution to maintaining a service mindset. Our program travels and is delivered in person at your workplace, nothing virtual. You simply can't practice the level of the skills this course teaches virtually. For more information, email me, cam@cammarston.com, and let's schedule a time to talk. Remember, you have less to fear from outside competition than you do from discourtesy and bad service from inside your own company. Again, email me, cam@cammarston.com, and let's talk about your business. We're back. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business, all housed in the University of Alabama. Arundhama, prior to the break, we were going to talk about the most common mistakes people make. What do you, you know, is there a list out there that you, I'm betting you've probably cited these mistakes 1,000 times in your writings and in your conversations, but for the purposes of educating my guests, what are the mistakes people make most commonly?
Sure. So I think that there is a long list of mistakes that people often make that could jeopardize their finances, at any stage of their lives. But the most important ones that I keep seeing people making is the amount of money that you're putting away for your retirement. Remember, there is never enough money that you can put away for your retirement. If you have a 401k with your employer, or if you are, if you have a 403b, and these are all products that you can put your money in order to save for retirement. Many people don't put enough, and that's a big mistake that they make. Remember, the power of compound interest. If you are able to put away as much as money as possible, you are gaining interest not only on the money that you put in, but also you're gaining interest on the interest income that you're generating on the savings. So a lot of people, while they're still in their 40s, late 40s, they are not putting away enough. Enough to me means at least 10% of your monthly income should be put away to a retirement. A lot of people fall short. Some of them put 3%, 5%, 6%. So that's a big mistake I do want to see people fixing. Even if you can't do 10% in your 20s and 30s, which I think you should, but if you can't, you should definitely move towards that number by the time you're in your late 30s, early 40s.
And the reason let me interrupt you real quick. The reason why is you're going to live longer than you think you are. Your expenses are going to be higher than you think they are. However, many people I know are saying 10%. I need that 10%. It's more important to me now than later, and we'll figure it out later, which is what you said before the break, is people kind of have the attitude of we'll figure it out later. What is your reply to somebody who says, I can't afford to give away 10%?
Well, look, if there's any stage of your life where you can still cut corners and cut expenses, it's probably in your 20s and 30s, because that's the age when you can afford to live in a small place. You can afford to not have certain things. But as you grow older, there are certain compulsory expenses you have to meet. So in my opinion, you really can't afford to, I would say, short-circuit yourself as far as savings go. Another important reason is while you are in your best earning years, 20s, 30s, 40s, and mid-50s, that's the time when you have an income. Your income is going to slow down gradually, so you will not be able to save enough money later on. So you might as well save during those 30, what I call the golden years, for anyone who's employed.
So we've got a, let's just pick a stereotypical listener of my show. He is, we'll pick 50 years old. He needs to be saving 10% of his income. Do you have any comments on how and where and why? Let's assume he's got a defined contribution plan, a 401k. Where should he put it? Do you have any risk factors and things of that nature?
Yes, absolutely. So the thumb rule is that you should, let's say hypothetically speaking, you have $500,000 in your retirement plan. Now, I would say around 25 to 30% of that money should be in certain stock market indices that's generating at least 10 to 11% returns annually, which means you should be in mid-cap stocks, small-cap stocks, as long as you're paying attention to the overall marketplace. Another 25 to 30% can easily be in what I call the safe stocks, which is like the Apples of the world, Apple and the Lockheed Martin. These are some of the big companies that are probably growing and give you returns between 6 to 7% per annum. They are paying good dividends. They are the safe stocks, but they're definitely generating more returns than a bank will offer you as interest. The remaining 40 to 50%, I would always advise people to have at least 10% of that, 10% out of that in cash or instruments similar to cash, like treasury bonds, which are safe. If you need money as an emergency fund in an emergency situation, you can sell quickly something and release cash and pay for expenses. And the remaining 25-30%, I would say you should definitely put in high quality bonds. It could be government bonds, it could be municipal bonds, because they're tax free, so there's a benefit. You can also put them in corporate bonds. The good news about our stock markets today is that there are a lot of transparent platforms that you can use to put your money in, including, I would say, alternative investments. So there are quite a few platforms that have come up where you can potentially invest in real estate. Real estate always generates good returns, I would say, even low to mid double-digit returns that often sometimes a stock market is not able to give you it during certain times in an economic cycle. Real estate investments can be a backup.
I see. So let's talk a little bit more about these alternative investments. And I feel like the 401k industry, and by the way, I have a 401k. I'm deeply indebted to it. It continues to, it's grown as I hoped it would. It's struggling right now, as everyone's is. But I, what if I say, hey, Arundhati, I want to create a 401k. And I think I want to invest it in my own timberland. I want to invest it in my own something. So it seems like a 401k right now, as I understand it, is a channel for money to go to the financial services companies where they have these, you know, 50, 60 story buildings in downtown Manhattan that cost a fortune. And I look and say, you know what? I'm making these guys a boatload of money. I should be making it for myself. I need a way to utilize what I'm using in my 401k to buy a piece of property that's a mile from my house that I think is going to appreciate. Is it possible that I can manipulate my 401k to buy things where I know the investment is going to increase versus some guy that's wearing a three-piece suit and Italian shoes in downtown New York City thinks it should go?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. The short answer is yes. If you have expertise by virtue of your work or your hobby or any kind of learning, and if you understand a particular industry very, very well. So let's take real estate, for instance. Let's say you understand land, you understand buildings, you understand the rental market, and you want to have an exposure to the real estate market. So there is a ways by which you can buy what they call REITs, it's a real estate investment trust, and these are extremely tax beneficial as well. So you can invest $10,000 and get a piece of a REIT that may have exposure to a particular neighborhood, a particular state, or a particular colony or district, and you can invest in the property in that particular area. Now, this is interesting because you may not be able to afford buying a home, buying a house, and putting it on rent. And there's a lot of hassles. But you can have investments in multiple REITs or multiple instruments that have exposures to property prices, property markets globally, in fact. That gives you the upside of what you can generate by being in real estate.
So
there are similar
I want to pause there. First thing, we've got to go to a break here in a moment. And I want to make sure we wrap this up because I want to hear.
Sure.
I think we started with number one, right? The number one mistake people made. We still haven't got on number two because I keep sidetracking us. But I want to go back to my question, which is I've got, let's say I've put a $500,000 in a 401k. It's all in cash. And I want to take that cash. And this is foolish, of course, that it would all be in cash. But I want to take that cash and buy a specific piece of property down the road. You're suggesting REITs, and I understand REITs, and I think in my 401k, I have a couple of those. But a REIT is still paying someone else. It's not paying me. It will in the end, but I'm hiring somebody else's expertise when I'm buying a REIT. What about my own personal expertise that is a piece of property a mile from my house that I know I can get for $500,000 and sell in 5 years for $750,000? Is that possible?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of people do that. The only caveat is you really have to understand at what stage of growth that neighborhood is. My thumb rule is if you do see certain smart things, a Starbucks, an art gallery, if you see them coming up, which probably means that it's attracting people with a certain level of income, which means the value of the property will go up. You also need to ensure that you've done a proper due diligence on the quality of the property. Get a good structural engineer in, because if you end up having to spend another $75,000 in year number three after you bought the property on the structure, then you're losing money. So these are some of the things that you have to take on board. The short answer is absolutely you can buy a property, put it on rent, and ensure that you have a steady income, and then sell the property for a profit.
And use it and use the 401k savings that I've created to make that transaction happen.
You could do that in certain circumstances. You can do that. Absolutely.
All right. Very good. Let's go to break and we'll get back to number two. If we can, I will be quiet and get back to number two, the second most challenging or biggest mistake people made in their own financial lives. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston on the phone with Arundham Nag out of New York City by way of India and London, financial services expert helping us out with this. You're listening to What's Working, brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, Culver House College of Business, University of Alabama. We'll be right back.
Life insurance is one of those subjects that make people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. I'm State Farm agent Allison Horner, and that's why I focus on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house insurance, or life without having to give up college insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call me, State Farm agent Allison Horner, and get to a better state with State Farm.
What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, housed in the Culver House College of Business at the University of Alabama. Arundham Nag is on the phone with me. His website is Sensei, Sensai.com, financial literacy website. We're talking now about the biggest mistakes people make in their own financial lives. We talked about number one, you're not saving enough, is the mistake number one. What's number two?
So number two is what I call living on borrowed money. And this is very important today because we are facing a high inflation rate environment over the next coming months. A lot of people, rather than cutting down their day-to-day expenses, they do shopping using their credit cards. And it's a very common mistake many Americans make. Now, a credit card, at the end of the day, you still have to pay off the credit card debt. A credit card debt usually comes with 17 to 25% annualized interest rate. And that's dangerous because what happens is after a couple of years, you discover that you have $45,000, $50,000 in credit card debt and you can't cope up. And then you default on the debt. It hurts your credit rating. And then you can't do a lot of things that you can do with a good credit rating. So that's a common mistake that a lot of people make. My advice is, if you can't afford something, ask yourself, do you need it? Cut down your expenses. It's okay not to eat out three times a week when it's a high inflation. Do your own home cooking. Reduce your home bill. It's okay to switch out the AC in your third bedroom if you're not using it. These are some of the things that people have to make when they are facing a high inflation, high cost environment.
We are certainly in a high inflation environment. The credit card thing got me. I'll admit that. As a college student, I had my education was not complete, but on a regular basis, I would get credit card offers in the mail. And as my allowance would for the month would kind of dwindle, I would often take those offers and use that credit card. And man, that burned me for about 7 or 8 years after college. It was ironic. I was getting credit card offers daily, seems like, in the mail. Though I had no job and no prospects for a job at the time, my mother, however, who had a nice business and at the time, was unable to get a credit card. And we're going to talk about the pendulum shift to the female influencer for finances in the household. But let's go back to the interest rate. Let's go back to a high inflationary time. We are seeing record inflation for there are people listening to the show that have never seen anything like this before. What is the consumer, somebody like me, need to know about good, solid financial decisions in times of inflation? Number one, you said, is take on debt, credit card debt during times of inflation. What else?
Well, I think the big picture is you can no longer live life without having a solid financial plan. Now, what do I mean by that? A financial plan can range from a very basic plan on your day-to-day expenses and amount of money you want to save, right up to how to manage your overall wealth into various asset classes. But the key, the most important thing when you are facing a high inflation environment is you have to spend time a little bit of time, I would say a couple of hours a week, in just understanding your upcoming financial needs, put it down in a paper, take a look at the costs that you may be incurring and see whether your income can support those expenses. Mind you, inflation does not necessarily mean that your wages is going up, because your wages and your salary, they were determined, let's say, a year ago, when you had the last conversation you had with your boss. Now, on that day, you did not know that Russia is going to invade Ukraine and there'll be a supply chain shock and the cost of bread in the supermarket has gone up by 35%. Even cat food, which used to cost 99 cents per can, the other day I got some cat food, it cost $1.20. That means a 30% increase in cat food. Now, this increase, 25-30% increase, is cascading across multiple items. So you need to have a solid plan as you sit down. There will always be three lists of items. Number one, basic, that you really cannot live without. Medicines, basic food, water, etc. Number two could be things that you can live without. And I would put gas expenses in one of them. Now, when I say gas expenses, not the gas that you need to go to the doctor, to the schools, or to your shopping mall, but the gas that you would probably be using for going out for the long weekends, long drives, they will have to be cut in the coming few months. And the third thing that you probably would want to do is there are certain expenses that are definitely luxury, celebratory, like, you know, going out 3-4 times in a week, or entertaining guests that you used to do, or just doing things that will make you feel good, you know, decorating the house or buying a new piece of furniture. Those are some of the things that you need to put down in a column and say, okay, not now, but maybe 6 months later, once the economy comes back up.
And I imagine it would be very tempting for someone who is saving 10% of their revenue to say, gosh, during times of high inflation, everything's getting more expensive. I'm no longer going to save 10%. I'm going to save 5%. I'm going to cut down on how much I'm saving for my future so that my lifestyle today doesn't change. Thoughts on that?
Yes. And the thing is, I do not believe in cutting down on your savings. And just on this point, a lot of people, they also pay off debt using their savings. Why am I against that? It's simply because that the power of compound interest is so powerful that you don't want to miss out on that opportunity. You would rather, if you've been saving, let's say, $200 a month or $250 a month, you want to continue to do that, because otherwise you're going to lose. Like if you are all of a sudden now saving 150 instead of 200, you're missing out on the income, the free money that your retirement fund will offer you on that extra $50 a month. So that's why I'm a big believer that if prices are going up, see if you can cut down your expenses.
Cut down expenses, don't cut down your savings. Makes complete sense. Hey, what is your... For if you're just joining in, I'm on the line with Arundham Nag. He's with Sensei. It's a website, financial literacy website, CENTSAI.com, full of content. I've clicked around, full of content. Wonderful stories of people as they've learned how to do some things differently. It's I highly suggest it. I wouldn't have him on the show if I didn't like it. So one of the things that I hear in my interaction with my financial services clients on the other side of the world, not other side of the world, but the different business hat that I wear of seminars and workshops, is the rising role of the female influencer. Do you see many gender differences when it comes to financial literacy?
Yes, we do. In fact, as a matter of fact, when we launched Sensei, and we did a lot of research on what the product should be, we realized that the biggest complaint was that most of the financial education content out there looks down upon women or doesn't take the women seriously, number one. Number two, women, they are, I wouldn't say, there is a notion that women don't take risk. That's actually not entirely true. What women do take risk, they do invest in the stock market. They're very much interested in the stock market. But the general financial habit associated with most women is they introduce an element of caution, like safety first. Let's ensure that we are spending money in the right items. Then let's see if we can buy a luxury item. But that is an incredible discipline that a woman brings to the table, number one. Number two, a woman, in my opinion, is the CFO in every family. Like if you look at most families out there, women normally are in charge of shopping, grocery shopping, buying things for the house. They're taking decisions. Now, they are probably using their partner's money or spouse's money in some cases, but the decisions are taken by them. So increasingly, some of the fintech companies or digital banks that are more successful in the last 10 years, they distinguish themselves by becoming more female-friendly. And that is a trend I do believe is going to continue over time.
That's interesting. And is it right to assume that much of the interface, if you will, that's driven in financial services, whether it be the app, whether it be the financial advisor, whether it be the website, the report that you get on a monthly basis, my guess is they're all created, formatted. The delivery is created by a male, yet more and more the decision maker, the CFO, is the female, and there could be disconnect between those two. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is accurate. Although I would say that the gap is narrowing of late. You do see many financial advisors, like in our business, we've seen many financial advisors who are women, and they only take on woman clients. In our own census world, we have 67% of our readers are actually women. And we know that because we look at the data all the time. And one of the reasons they like our website is because it is visually appealing. We actually do, we have pictures of women in our articles. It's mobile friendly. And I think the key thing here is to basically treat the male and the female equally, not talk down at women. I still remember an old banking advertisement was, it wanted to show success of its credit card. And it had this elderly gentleman with his arm around a much younger woman and with a dog and a white picket fence. Now, those things are changing. Today, the woman has more power. And that empowerment is showing in the way financial services are advertising their products these days. And that is a big change we're seeing.
Arindam Nag is the... Arindam, what is your title there? I never even asked.
So I'm the CEO and one of the co-founders of Sensei.
CEO, co-founder of Sensei, CENTSAI.com. You'll find them online. Financial literacy. Folks, if you've got a workforce, and you see some curious decision-making of your workforce, point them to Sensei and let that workforce take a look out there so they don't make a bad mistake. And Arindam, I know we could go on and on about financial struggles and how those financial struggles create stress and stress creates health vulnerabilities. There's a lot behind this. We've touched the tip of the iceberg. I want to thank you for your time and ask if you'd be willing to go back and let's get into this at another point in another angle. I think there's so much to discuss here.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think financial stress is one of the biggest contributors towards stress in the workplace as well. And that's one of the reasons why we were compelled to launch a financial education product just for the workplace.
Let's have a show about the side effects of financial stress and what employers need to know about it when we get on the line again. Sound good?
Absolutely. We'd be happy to.
We'll be back after this break for segment 5. Thank you, Arindam. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, Culver House College of Business, University of Alabama.
This is Trey Langus with Transworld Business Advisors. You've worked for years to grow and build your business, and now you're considering an exit strategy. Selling your business can be intimidating and complex. Let our local team at Transworld Business Advisors help you. We are the largest business brokerage in the world, and I will personally and confidentially guide you through this process. I'm Trey Langus. Find me at Transworld Business Advisors or Google my name.
Hey, this is Billy Duran. I'm the president of Threaded Fasteners. And when I'm not down at the Nut House, I'm listening to What's Working with Cam Marston. Now back to the show.
Financial literacy, like I said in segment one when we opened the show, is something I think everybody thinks they know. But when you get into the weeds about it, people don't. We're back. You're listening to What's Working. I'm Cam Marston. What's Working is brought to you by the Alabama Center for Real Estate, Culverhouse College of Business, University of Alabama. Again, glad you're on with me. Arundhem undoubtedly has a treasure chest full of advice. And it's advice that I've heard a number of different times. I wish there was a way to make saving for our retirement, yours and mine, more sexy. And that's a word I get accused of saying way too much, but make it more glamorous. And I think one of them could be, just like you heard me kind of push him to make sure I was clear on the answer, is if I can put my money into a 401k pot, and then I can use the money that's in that pot to invest it the way I want to, because there are tax benefits to saving money in a 401k. And I could put that money into that 401k, and then I direct the specific use of that savings in an investment that I feel will do well. Right now, as I said, I feel like these 401ks are channels through which we throw money into someone else's hands. And I'm going to get a long-term benefit, yes, from the rising, you know, the value of it, the compounding interest rates and things like that that Arundhem said. But I think if I would, and I used real estate as an example, but what about art? That's something I've been reading about on the sidelines, is the extraordinary appreciation of certain types of art. Let's assume I follow one particular artist and I think his or her artwork is going to skyrocket soon. I want to make that bet on myself using my saved 401k dollars to purchase that art, set it in a warehouse, a closet, on my wall, whatever, and know that in X many years, that investment is going to come back to the marketplace as I put this artwork back out there to fund my retirement. Artwork, timberland, real estate, etc. Right now, it goes into some dark hole. Yeah, I get a statement, but I don't know who is managing my money. I don't know what that guy or that lady's name is. I don't know their background. I don't know what their motives are. And I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. I've always been taught that if I can bet on myself, I should. And that's the biggest guarantee I can make, is to bet on myself. And managing that 401k money my own way might just do that. However, my suspicion is there are restrictions and documents and lawyers and Indian chiefs that got to get involved in this thing that prevent you and me from doing that, that prevent you and me from banking on our own, or creating bank, let's say, for our own retirement. There we go. Stir the pot for the day. Arundhem may have a different opinion on that. I do think there's a lot of content he and I need to get to at some point about financial induced stress and how it looks. But we will save that for another day. We'll wrap it up. Find me, Cam Marston, on all your favorite and least favorite social media places, Cam Marston or Cam Marston the number one. You can find this podcast at whatsworkingcam.com. Don't forget the new book, What Works, the 10 best ideas from the first 200 episodes. By the time this show airs, you should be able to find that book on my website, CamMarston.com. Brand new website. Go take a look and tell me how this investment was well worth it. Please tell me that the investment was well worth it. What's Working is produced by John Thompson with Eye on Digital. We'll have another show next week. Have a good week, everybody.